9 a.m. This meeting is called to order. Can I get a roll call, please?
Ms. Powell?
Present.
Dr. Knopf?
Here.
Dr. Arena?
Present. Okay, I'd like to start by recognizing our newly licensed chiropractors. It's part of your continuing education to attend one of our meetings in the first year that you're licensed, and so thanks for attending. I think that you'll learn some useful information about why some people present in front of the board, and it should probably help you in your practice as well. So we will start with tab number one under initial action on complaints in the matter of Dr. Brian Rand. Can I get a board brief?
Allegations against Dr. Rand include danger to the health, safety, and welfare of the public, improper treatment, malpractice, and unprofessional conduct.
Okay, is Dr. Rand here? Hi, come on up and have a seat, please. And do we have anybody here to speak? Patient? Hi, what is your name or initials? Okay, you can come on up and have a seat as well, please. Hi. Doctor, can you please introduce your name into our recorded record?
I'm Dr. Brian Rand.
Okay, thank you. And we have a complainant here, initials FW. Thank you. So there are a couple of allegations that we have here. Everybody's going to get a chance to talk and answer questions and give us information, but we need to speak one at a time and slowly for the recorded audio record. So we have a couple of allegations for improper treatment, potential malpractice, and unprofessional conduct. So I'm going to ask my board members first if they have any questions for the doctor.
Not at this time. I'd like to hear their account first.
Okay.
Same.
Ms. Powell?
Yes, same.
Okay. So we read all the board meeting materials. You know, we've read the complaint and the replies to the complaints. So I'd like to hear if you have any additional information that you'd like to give to us right now or explain, you can. Otherwise, we'll ask the patient what her account is.
No.
Okay. And to our patient, thank you for joining us today. You know, my understanding reading through the board meeting materials is that you felt like this doctor's fractured your sacrum?
Yeah.
Okay, and when I read through the records, what I read specifically is that it sounded like he lied to you on your back. He had a staff person come in and hold your ankles down, and then he put a towel around your neck and he did some type of traction adjustment to your neck. And you feel like from that point forward, your symptoms were worse, and eventually you were diagnosed with a sacrum fracture.
Correct.
And so as I read through the board meeting materials, you know, it was interesting to me because in order to get a fracture of a bone, you need some type of compression force to make that happen. And so I've never heard in 25 years practicing of a traction technique on a cervical spine on your neck that would cause a sacral fracture. And so as I read through the records, I saw that there were some prior traumas that you had experienced, and I wondered if your prior traumas maybe predated the treatment that you received, and then eventually it was diagnosed. And I totally get it if you felt like your symptoms were made worse at some point from the procedure he did, but the part that I don't think is possible is him fracturing your sacrum as a result of a traction technique on your neck. And so any additional thoughts that you have on that or anything that you can clarify will be very helpful for us in determining that. And so one of the questions I have is regarding your low back and sacrum and leg neuropathy and pain down your leg and those types of problems that you were having, did any of that predate the neck adjustment that he gave you?
Excuse me.
Yeah, you don't have to get real close to the mic.
Yes. Well, I'm 70 years of age, so, you know, I have been going to chiropractors for about 30 years, so I have had previous adjustments. And yes, there was a lower back pain with my L4 and L5, and that's correct. However, never in any of these adjustments did I hear the noise that emanated from my body when I was pulled like that. And so it is true, I walked out and I just thought, well, okay, that's, you know, and I drove home. And the next day I had to go to do an errand, and when I pressed on my accelerator in the car, I had this tremendous pain all the way up my back, and I had to pull over just almost immediately, get out of the car, and stand up, and just, I didn't know where the pain was coming from. Well, because this was December 28th, of course, the new year was coming, I called my cervical spine doctor's office. I made an appointment January 2nd. The PA was in there because the doctor was on vacation. He basically gave me a Flexeril script and ordered an MRI. This is the first time that I have ever had a sacral fracture. I was still in pain, so no one, you know, from just getting the diagnosis, I didn't know how to solve the problem. So on January 5th, I went to the ER at Abrazo Arrowhead. They did another second MRI. I had morphine. I was released with no pain med, just said, we can't do anything for you. I then went to Mayo's ER on January 7th. Basically was told the same thing. They had the records, so they already knew, you know, the diagnosis. At least that doctor gave me 12 oxycodone. They were so afraid I was going to become addicted to opiates that no one would give me a pain med. Then on January 9th, I went by ambulance. I was in pain. I was lying on the floor. I could not move. I went by ambulance to Vanna Roswell, where they did a third MRI with contrasts. And this was more extensive, and that's the report that you got. They still sent me home with no pain med. Because I'm a retired nurse, I ordered the A&P books and the brain books, and I had to study this myself because no one was going to help me. So I am a widow, I live alone, I have two dogs to care for, so I had to just rest. I did that for 2.5 months. I progressed to a zero gravity chair where I could elevate my backside, and I was wearing adult Depends the whole time I was incontinent. And I finally got a back brace from Nova Spine on March 3rd. Then a month later, April 3rd, I was given injections that did nothing, but I had seen another spine doctor, and he had recommended I have laminectomy and spinal fusion for my L4 and 5. So I had to wait until May 14th to have that surgery at Abrazo Arrowhead, and I am now 10 weeks post-op. The numbness and tingling, you know, has subsided tremendously. Once the sacral fracture was healed, basically by me not moving, I lost 15 pounds of basically muscle mass, and I just couldn't do anything. And I'm still recovering, still taking it slow. It'll be another 12 to 18 months before the fusion really takes place. But if you could have heard the noise that came out of my body, even though you do have, and I recognize your 25 years of experience, I can tell you from medical professionals, retired medical professional, not one of the hospitals I went to, nor their staff, no one knew how to treat a sacral fracture. They all wanted me to lie on my back. I couldn't. I had gotten not a wheelchair, but the
walker.
And the only way I could move myself was to lie on my stomach, propelling myself from my back legs, and I kept trying to explain. I could not sit down. They all wanted me to sit down in a wheelchair. Just sit down. I said, I can't. I went to the hospital in the ambulance. I said, I have to lie down. And none of the ambulance drivers knew that, you know, person was in that much pain. But I have to tell you, I've had two fractured wrists. I've had several rib fractures, a sternum fracture. I've had my C5-7 is fused. In all, I just cannot tell you the amount of pain that I suffered. And I just wasn't given any pain med, and I just had to endure it and learn how to deal with it on my own, which I did.
Can you tell me if what was the time frame from the adjustment that you received and when the pain really ramped up? How many days went by before you really
got sore? It was the next day. And like I said, I walked out and didn't think, you know, there was a problem, but
right.
I guess over the course of the evening and lying, you know, sleeping or whatever, just was enough. But with the osteoporosis that Dr. Rand knew about,
do you recall when did he adjust your low back? Did he lay you on your side and adjust your low back?
No,
did he do any other manipulation?
On my back, he wrapped. The towel goes around and he pulls like that. I had never had that kind of adjustment from any other chiropractor.
Did he work on your hips? Did he work on your, did he do anything to your low back?
Nothing else was done.
Thank
you. Just that jerk and the noise and all of us there were three of us in the room. And I said, did you hear that? Oh my goodness. And it was just such a startling noise. I can't even describe. It was like a vacuum or a whoosh sound.
It sounds like it really scared you.
It did, and I sort of got up and...
Okay. So, a follow-up question. Is there a pending malpractice matter? Is there a lawsuit that is happening right now regarding this?
No.
Okay.
No.
All right, thank you. I'm going to ask my board members if they have any additional questions for you now, and then we're going to give the doctor a chance to explain any additional information.
Okay.
Yes. Chairman, I'd like to ask her a couple.
Go ahead, Ms. Powell.
First, I'm so sorry that you went through so much pain and trauma. I mean, back to back. So
thank you.
When I first read about your case, I actually contacted a radiologist to learn more, not being a doctor, about this type of fracture. I don't think that the fracture was caused by an adjustment or anything the doctor did. You mentioned that you walked 2 miles in that period of time, which is putting a lot of pressure, right? And the assault that you suffered for an hour.
When did I walk 2 miles?
It was in your note, in the notes that you had gone for a walk, and that's what caused you to be so exhausted. Do you recall that statement?
No, I have. The last payment that I made to Dr. Rand, I finally found it because he doesn't take insurance, and so it wasn't on my Medicare.
And then you went back to go back to see him. Why did you go back after the first adjustment?
Well, there hadn't been an issue, but we only did, we call it a towel. the TAL adjustment, but this time he called in the receptionist. She held my legs down, so I was pretty rigid when this
yanked. That was your first adjustment. So she didn't remember your adjustment.
No. This was not a first adjustment with Dr. Rand.
Okay.
It was like the third. It was either second or third, and it was the last, because after that, the next day, that's when I attempted to do an errand, and like I said, I just got a half a block, and the pain was so great in my right leg, and I had to pull over, and there was even a person that turned around and stopped because he thought I was trying to push the car, and I couldn't stand up. I was holding on to the car, getting, you know, out of traffic. And I said, no, I have this horrible pain. I just don't know where it's coming from. And all the while, I was thinking, you know, it was in my vertebrae. I mean,
did any of these doctors that you saw at Banner or the other facilities explain to you about this type of fracture?
All basically said, sorry, we can't do anything for you.
Right, but did they talk to you what causes it?
No.
Didn't take any time to explain anything to you. Shame on the profession. I'm so sorry. Somebody should have taken the time to explain it. I think when you saw the word fracture in the report, it sounds worse than it actually is, and it's not uncommon in older, like us, to have these things. Yeah. So, again, I don't think it's the adjustment that caused the fracture, and it could have been there for a long time.
Well, it never showed up on previous MRIs. Nowhere. I had my entire cervical vertebrae, my entire body MRI,
low back,
because I was going to move to Belize. So I wanted to be completely checked out. Nowhere in any of those MRIs, and that cervical doctor even requested that I bend over and bend back.
But this was a cervical MRI of your neck, not
your
low back.
It was the entire
spine. And that was how much time, not that it matters, because it wouldn't matter. It could have happened in between.
And that was August of 2017. Mm.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Was that from the SimonMed Imaging Center? Is that the records that we have on file then?
No, the record, I don't know which. I believe I sent in the Banner of Boswell because it was the most extensive, and I had gotten it from the actual records after I was released from the hospital. But I had Simon Med from this issue. The Desert Institute for Spine Care, PA, had requested it. So I went, and I usually get things done at Simon Med. So I went immediately. They gave me a night appointment. I found out what the results were, but I didn't have a copy that they hadn't done their, you know, written report yet, so I actually didn't have a written copy. The copy that I submitted to Mayo ER came from the Abruzzo ER MRI. They told me, because I went in on a Saturday evening, they couldn't access Simon Med's records, so they had to do their own MRI. So from that report, that's how I was able to get, the document to present to Mayo's ER, so they didn't do an MRI. However, when I went back to Banner Boswell, they, of course, wanted their own MRI, so they did it with contrast. I mean, I was in that tube for an hour and 45 minutes. Of course, I was sedated, so I was listening to Mozart, but, the only way I could lie on my back was to have morphine drip. And then they just observed me and basically said, well, you can go to rehab. And I looked at the documents, and they could just keep me there. And I said, no, I have to go home. I have two docs to take care of. So one of my wonderful neighbor. She came over and fed the dogs and walked them and basically fed me for a couple of weeks till I could flip back over and, you know, kind of move around. But I didn't have any pain med. I had already taken the 12 oxycodone, which didn't even really do anything other than put me to sleep, which was great because, you know, I didn't feel pain. But then I just woke up and it was still painful. But
do you have any further questions?
Yeah, I'm sorry that I stepped in, Angela. Do
no,
you have
that's,
any?
That's okay. I'm done.
Just to help me clarify the timeline of events, the adjustment that occurred that you believe caused you injury, was this the your visit on December 21st?
No, 28th.
The 28th is where. Okay, thank
because
you.
Because then I went because of, you know, the New Year's, I couldn't get in, and I, when I think back about it, I should have gone to the ER right away, but I was really thinking that it was more my spine. I had no idea it was the sacrum that was fractured.
That's, thank you, ma'am. That's all I have for the patient.
Okay, Ms. Powell, anything additional?
I have some questions for the doctor.
Okay.
I was looking at your soap notes or your notes on the patient. I was disappointed. You've taken 12 hours CE from Greg Friedman. You've taken 12 hours from Greg Friedman. CE hours in record keeping and documentation. These notes look like 1970s notes. It would have been nice to have some history about her condition, even osteoporosis. I thought that the notes were very good. It doesn't help when you have a case like this, a complaint. You need to make sure your notes are really up to speed. And you've taken enough classes to know better. So I just had to comment.
Real quick. Well, the patient, the first day she came in, she was in a lot of pain, had a huge migraine to the point of nausea. And so that exam wasn't like any other exam that I do. I was trying to do my best to comfort the patient and help her the best I can. And so I didn't really, you know, that's why that initial report.
And we're talking about November 16th, 2018.
What's that?
November 16th was her first date of service?
Yeah, no, the 10th.
10th, okay.
Yeah. And so I didn't give them, you know, as much information as I should have. The patient was complaining that, you know, the questions were causing her more pain, so I didn't want to do that. So, you know, I basically took an x-ray of her neck and then, you know, got her some treatment. So that's typically why it's been that bad. Not all of my notes are like that. This was an unusual case for me and just wanted to help the patient the best that I could and get her some relief.
You did take lumbar x-rays, didn't you?
No, I took...
thoracic. No, you didn't.
No, I took neck x-rays and then she sent me an email, I think later that evening. I didn't get till the following weekend that she had some upper chest pain. So when she came back in, I took a chest x-ray just to make sure that no fractures occurred. That's when she told me that she had osteoporosis, so I was a little more careful.
Any further questions?
No.
So as I read through your treatment notes, I see that on the 7th, or on the 1st of December, it was more upper back pain related. On the 7th of December, you have patient had a fall on Wednesday, complaints of coccyx pain.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of the details of that fall? Do you remember, I mean, what are we talking about, fell into a chair or fell on the ground? Do you remember any of that?
It's very big. I believe it was on the ground, and I believe it was like at our friend's house.
Okay.
She slipped and fell.
All right. And so we're going to switch back to our patient now. Do you remember falling in early December?
No.
Okay. And then...
I can add to that.
Oh, absolutely.
I had gotten a job with Super Shell So I was driving a super shuttle, and I was a contract driver, and the owner recommended Dr. Rand. And I said, well, I wasn't happy with my previous chiropractor many, many years. And I said, okay, well, I'll go try him. And so after I had a treatment, and he was the very first time I met him, I had not taken my migraine medication because I wanted to see if he could alleviate the pain. And yes, he did. He did help, and I liked him. But anyway, so
I'm trying to understand if there's anything else that may have caused your problems other than the treatment, and so I'd like you to be specific in your answers.
Driving, and because I was working a 12-hour shift, I was active, but nothing out of the ordinary, and I hadn't fallen any time because I was working, and I just hadn't fallen.
Okay, so our records indicate that. So you said around December 28th is when you were in a lot of pain, like the day after that treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The week before, there was sounded like a very significant trauma, date rape situation that happened. Do you feel like that could have contributed to your pain, or do you feel like you had any PTSD-type symptoms that may have been a startle reaction when you got that adjustment and it scared you?
No,
that could have contributed?
No, because even though there was pain afterwards, it subsided within, a couple of days, the soreness wore off. And then I went back, like I said, December 28th, and I went back to driving, and I just needed an adjustment.
Okay.
And this time, it was pretty traumatic.
Okay.
And again, I can't tell you the noise that my body made.
You don't have to tell us again because we already heard it. All right. So at this point, I'm going to give my my board members one final chance to interview anybody they want to, and then we're going to decide what we're going to do today, if we're going to continue this matter for further investigation, dismiss it, or otherwise. So, board members, do you have any further questions?
Just one comment. It was December 28th, Saturday, that you had walked 2 miles, it says, the same time frame, so just so you're aware. Okay? You may have forgotten that.
Okay, so that's not a question. You're just reflecting the records. Are there any questions?
Yes, I've got a follow-up question for the patient. You said that you're driving as part of your work. In the driver's seat, is it a hydraulic seat at all? Is it cushioned for you?
Yes. I'm no longer driving.
Sure. But is there almost like a suspension system in the driver's seat like they often have on city buses or things like that? Are you familiar with the kind of driver's seat I'm talking about?
Yes, I'm familiar with it, but I can't recall. It's a van.
Okay.
And it was one of only the seven handicap accessible vans.
Okay, so we're done asking questions at this point, and I'm going to ask my board members, looking at the allegations in front of us, if they feel like this, if they'd like to make a motion to dismiss or continue the investigation or otherwise.
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion for an order of non-disciplinary continuing education.
For what?
In this case, for record keeping. One of the things that I noticed in the patient chart notes is treatment was delivered on that final day, December 28th, but there's no record of any treatment provided on the 28th. Pretty much the same, no adjustment was being made. So I think just a refresher and some record keeping is appropriate for this case.
Okay, so that motion then would be to issue a clear violation or a letter of concern for record keeping. Which one? A clear violation for record keeping?
For record keeping,
and
yes.
And then an order for how many hours to be completed and what time frame for continuing education?
I would say 4 hours within 3 months.
Specifically in record keeping?
Correct.
Okay, is there a second?
A second motion.
Okay, now we can discuss further. Ms. Powell, you had something?
No, I'm just happy to say that I hope you'll take those four hours of CE, and maybe from a different instructor, different course, because...
Okay, yeah. I'm going to go ahead and call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Did you say?
Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the board has decided to take action. He's going to receive a non-disciplinary advisory letter regarding record keeping, and he's got some requirements to comply with that. We did not find any cause related to your sacral fracture, so thank you for coming today. We really appreciate your testimony.
Thank you for listening.
Okay. Okay, let's go on to the next tab, which is tab number 2 in the matter of Scott Johnson. Hi, can you please introduce yourself into our recorded record?
Scott Michael Johnson.
Thank you. Dr. Kolash, do you have a board briefing?
Yes. Allegations are conviction of a misdemeanor, failure to provide information to the board, and unprofessional conduct.
Okay, we've read all the board meeting materials. Do you have anything you would like to say additionally? Okay. Board members, do you have any questions for the doctor?
I guess it's just the most obvious one. In your renewal application, we asked if there's been any arrests or convictions or felonies. We know from some of the records here that there was an arrest date of 12/9/2018. Why was that not reflected in the
record? I don't know. I guess at the point I was not thinking that it was arrested. I guess it wasn't a conviction yet. And so, either misreading of the words. At the time I didn't think I was, that there was no conviction yet. That's about all I can say to that.
Ms. Powell?
I have no questions.
Okay.
And I've got
okay.
Mr. Chair. I believe, so once you did receive the conviction, I'm just trying to find it here in the records, I think that was within 2019 at that point, and you did submit an email following that, and I believe our statute said within 10 days, and I think it was just a little bit past that at that point.
I was thinking I was... I didn't know anything about a 10-day, and so once it was convicted, I tried my best to be, compliant with letting the board know. My fault for, not knowing the rules better. If it was not before 10 days.
Okay. Dr. Knopf, I'll just note that the statute requires reporting of arrests as well within 10 days, not just conviction.
Correct. Thank you.
So I appreciate you self-reporting, and I understand the difficulty if you're not repetitively arrested and brought in front of the board like this. Most people don't know the rule, but you still are supposed to know the rule and report regardless of conviction if you're arrested. And then, and then it's on our radar and we can investigate it and see that you're complying with everything that you're supposed to, which is why we're here today. So, are there any other questions at this point?
I've done any further ones.
Okay. Can I get a motion to break into executive session?
I'll make a motion to go into executive session to seek legal advice.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. not opposed. Everybody can stay here. We're going to get legal counsel in the next room, and then we'll be back in with them. Okay, we're back in regular session. Thanks for your patience. So I've got some questions for you about the incident that occurred. Let's start with you had your incident and your DUI at the car wash. They've got video footage of you hanging out there for a long time, you know, over 60 minutes. Talking to different people, customers. What was all that about? You know, it doesn't sound like you damaged any property. What could you possibly have been talking to them about? Do you remember? Why would you involve them?
At one point, I remember, you know, sitting in the waiting area, and I think some people passed by, and it's just kind of chit chat as people are waiting for vehicles.
Okay, so this was like a drive-through car wash where you get out of your car and you hang out and wait, and maybe they have a fish tank in the middle or something like that. So you're exposed to other people in there. Okay, so you're waiting for your car, and were you having arguments with them? Anything heated or just okay? So the record says that it sounds like they gave you a ticket that you didn't know that you got the ticket or not, and you were upset about that, and then you weren't sure that you got the right change. So you went inside and you paid?
So I paid for a certain basic car wash.
Okay.
Went in and paid, and it was more.
Okay.
At that point, there was a mistake that they didn't give me the clean ticket type of thing.
Okay.
And so, you know, the discussion with the cashier was on those things.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so this sounds like the kind of place that might take 20 or 30 minutes to wash your car anyway.
Correct.
They're drying it. They're doing the whole thing. Okay.
If you're doing one of the upper level washes, it's definitely, you'd be there 30 minutes.
Okay. So in the meantime, they report you. You get arrested. You blow a .14. A couple of hours later, you know, which is pretty significant.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so what has happened since then? What kind of treatment have you had? You know, what reassurance will we have that this may never happen again? Do you still drink? You know, what's changed since then?
So I went through 36 hours of counseling. Learned quite a bit in that.
Counseling with who?
Say again?
Counseling with who?
STI, Scottsdale Treatment Institute.
Okay. So 36 hours of counseling.
Mm-hmm. Went to some driver's ed courses.
Okay.
That was through the state of Arizona.
Okay.
And jail time.
How many days in jail?
2 days.
2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so how has this affected your life since then? Like, so what?
Well, it's been a struggle with the family. We've definitely come to a good place, and we're moving forward. But it's been something to go through.
So your testimony today is that you don't drink anymore?
Correct.
Okay, and so what date is your sobriety date?
That would have been January, early January.
So after
an exact date there.
Okay, so
that was some real come to Jesus moments with the family.
So, do you have any other substance abuse problems? Okay. Has this ever trickled into your practice? You ever have any trouble with your patients over drinking issues?
No.
Okay. So, board members, do you have any further questions for Dr. Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Dr. Johnson, did you have any screening or evaluations that you had to go through? I know you had 36 hours of counseling, but...
It was part of counseling, of course. It started with a screening interview to be able to place me. The recommendation of the counselor was actually for 16 hours based on that interview and my responses to the questionnaires.
Okay.
Legally, though, we found out later that blowing that .14 or whatever it was, that legally it has to be 36, but it started as a recommendation of 16 for the level he thought I was at.
Okay. And were there any other outcomes discussed? Did they feel like this was a one and done kind of situation? Was it, yeah, this was maybe from the past and it's reoccurring right now? Do they go into any of those kind of specifics on their assessments with you?
In the assessment, it was just more of it seems that this is a one-time bad day occurrence.
So have you complied with everything that you have had to comply with that has been ordered by the state?
Absolutely.
Okay.
All of my fines are paid, jail time's done, all of the counseling is done, everything with AZDOT is finished. I currently have the interlock system on the vehicle. I'm due for recalibration, which means an assessment to make sure that I've complied and haven't had any bad deems with blowing into the interlock system, and due for that in the middle of September. Had a recalibration in middle June. Everything is clean and clear.
So historically, the board has always, issued a concurrent probationary status to at least mimic the state requirements. And so that's one of the options that we have today would be to offer you either a consent agenda to agree to some typical terms of probationary status, which could include random drug screening and potentially an evaluation with an addictionologist to make sure that you have no other issues and that you're safe for practice. I'm going to ask my board members if they have any further questions for you, and then we're going to decide what kind of action we want to take, if we want to offer you that consent agenda or if we want to continue this to a formal interview where it would give us the same options to impose disciplinary probationary status without you just agreeing to a consent agreement. So do you have anything else you'd like to tell us before they may have some more questions for you?
No, I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you. Board members, any continued questions?
I have no further questions.
None for me, Mr. Chair.
Okay, then this is the time when we'll go ahead and deliberate what kind of action we're going to take in this matter. What's your pleasure? Anybody want to make a motion?
Mr. Chair, it seems like that there were some evaluations performed already as part of the disciplinary action taken by the state. I don't think we have any access to any of that based off of what we're provided. But for me, I think it would be important to see the outcomes of any assessments given. And if there weren't any that satisfy what we're looking for, we might issue a different means to get to the information what we're looking for. Is this potentially an ongoing problem?
So we could direct staff to request those records directly from wherever he had his...
Correct.
And if not, in a future meeting, we can impose our own.
Right.
Okay. Okay. So did you want to make a motion to continue this to a formal interview then for further investigation?
Yes, I'll make the motion to continue this to a formal interview so that we have time to just gather some of the assessment and evaluation outcomes if staff could please collect those.
A second motion.
Second. Okay. Any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, let's call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, we're going to continue this matter so we can request your documentation right from the source, and then you'll be on a future agenda where we can come back and we can try to discuss what we'll do.
Scottsdale Treatment Institute and Ken Sharp.
Okay.
As a counselor.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. That's good for today. You can be dismissed at this point, and we're going to go on to our next tab. Thank you. Okay, we are moving on to tab number 3, the matter of Dr. Joseph Greer. This is the whether to open. Is doctor here? Is he signed in to speak?
Doctor is not signed in to speak. The complainant, Tim, has signed in.
Okay, great. We'd like the complainant to step up, and you can have a seat up here by the microphone. Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
We have an audio recorded record, so if you can just say your initials into the microphone, we want to protect your identity so you don't have to say your name, just initials.
M.R.
Thank you. And Dr. Kolesch, can I get a board brief?
There's a complaint against Dr. Greer for making false statements, misleading advertising, improper billing, and unprofessional conduct.
Okay, thank you. And to our complainant, I want to tell you that you can be assured we've read all the meeting materials and we've read your complaint. And so this is your opportunity to clarify or offer us any additional information that you think is pertinent right now. Do you have anything you'd like to say?
Just that the severe pain that I experienced occurred approximately 5.5 hours after the adjustment was made.
Okay. And the purpose of our meeting today is to decide whether we're going to actually open up a formal case and continue this investigation or not. So I thank you for your testimony because this is going to help us determine that. I want you to know that we do not get involved in fee disputes.
Understood.
And I understand that, you know, it sounded like there was a $1,000 credit line taken out by Care Credit, which was assigned to maybe some of the value of your visits, but also it looked like you paid for some of your visits. And so although we don't get involved in fee disputes, we do get involved when there's fraudulent activity. And so if you can maybe clarify a little bit, you know, I've got a timeline here that it looks like around March of 2019, you met the doctor at a wellness at a convention center, or
I'm a Pima County employee.
Okay.
So it was a wellness clinic sponsored by Pima County as well as the city of Tucson.
And so they offered you some type of enticement offer, some type of discounted evaluation,
correct. It was a free one-time visit.
And was Dr. Greer on the premises for that time?
Yes, he was present.
Okay. And so then you did show up for a treatment around March 29th. And then it sounded like they were recommending some type of 40-visit care plan in April of 2019. And then at some point you got involved and agreed to this Care Credit contract. Didn't get the relief you were looking for and or felt worse, and then went to your PCP around April 18th, went to physical therapy, and then you were looking for a refund from the Care Credit. Is that what happened?
I was looking for a refund from the doctor to the Care Credit financing, correct.
Okay, and I'm not sure that they can do that or not because you're signing a contract with Care Credit, and it's kind of like opening up a credit card in your name through Care Credit. So I don't know that that's a possibility.
Pursuant to a conversation that I had with Care Credit, they advised me that I could speak directly to the doctor, and the doctor could make a financial adjustment based on the services rendered.
Okay, and so that part is between you and the doctor, I think, mostly. And so what we're here to talk about mostly is the how do you feel like you were injured?
Well, initially what happened was after the adjustment, or the adjustment that was made, I woke up with severe burning pain from the middle of my thigh to the middle of my shin, and when I went to stand, I had absolutely no strength in my right leg to support my standing.
Okay.
I contacted my visit was on a Friday. The pain occurred during the middle of the night.
So did you?
Before midnight.
Excuse me, did you feel like during the treatment at all that you felt worse, or did you feel better after the treatment and then and sometimes that can happen where you can feel worse a day or two later?
Actually, at the treatment, I felt relief.
Okay.
And my complaint that I had was my lower back. I was feeling lower back pain on and off for quite a very long time.
Okay.
However, one of the things that the doctor did mention prior to him actually adjusting me, he stated that I was off balance by about an inch and a half.
Okay.
In his conversation with me, what he had expressed was that I might feel some relief, but I wasn't going to be completely fixed, if you will.
Right.
So he did a back adjustment, and in addition to that, he had me turn and he pulled my right leg, which surprised me.
So did he lie you on your side? He had you lying on your side?
He had me lying on my stomach.
Okay.
And he did back adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
And the table...
The table dropped a little bit?
Yeah.
Made a loud noise?
Yes, and okay. It continued to make noises. Yeah. He was doing the adjustment.
Yeah.
He had me turn to my back.
Okay.
And extend my legs. And he pulled my right leg.
So he grabbed on your foot or your ankle and he tugged
and
on it?
Jerked.
Right.
When he jerked, there was a pop.
Right, in your hip.
My right leg, which scared me.
Right.
Because I have had 2 total hip replacements.
Oh, wow.
And so...
Did you tell him that you had the hip replacements?
Absolutely.
Okay. And so... You know, and I respect your time, and it sounds like we have plenty reason to continue this investigation. And so I'm going to briefly ask my board members if they have any questions for you, but this will be a lot more purposeful when we have the doctor here and we compel him to come and show up to the meeting. He was not required to come today.
Understood.
But we're going to have a whole bunch of questions for him about what happened and try to get to the bottom of this. So board members, do you have any questions?
No, I think there's...
Okay, so does someone want to make a motion to open up a complaint?
Yes, I'll make the motion to open this complaint.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, I don't think we need any further discussion. I'll go ahead and call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. So you'll be invited back. We appreciate your testimony. It always goes better when the complainant shows up, because we can really get to the truth and bottom of what happened, and then we'll bring the doctor in too, and or his attorney. You know, you can have an attorney. You don't need one, but you'll be invited back at a later meeting date. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Next tab is tab number 5 regarding licensure. Oh, 4. I'm sorry. No, we just did 4, didn't we? Okay, 4. So, Dr. James Kelleher. Hi.
Hi.
Can you have a seat, please, and introduce your name for the record?
James Kelleher.
Kelleher, thank you. Okay, Dr. Kolash.
Dr. Kelleher's license was placed on probation on April 27, 2019, for a term of 2 years. He has petitioned the board to release that probation.
Okay, hi. Thanks for coming today. So, you have not been on probation for very long. We had a 2-year term of probation. I think we're only into it about 3 months. Is that correct?
That sounds about right.
Okay, and you do have the option for early termination if all of the conditions are met. But I believe we are missing one. Is that correct?
Should not be.
Let me pull up my materials quickly here. Okay, so documentation reflecting the completion of the court-required probation has not been received in our memo. Did we get that?
There are documentations that he participated in those, but there's not a document that says full completion has been done from the court.
Okay. So, are we missing anything or not?
The order does require that all documentation is provided as part of the order. So, I believe page 5 shows completion of some of that monitored probation, but we don't have anything further stating that the unsupervised probation was completed. And per the order, that would have been required as well.
Okay. So we're waiting on more documentation.
So there's no more documentation to be provided. I called at the end of my probation and spoke with the person who deals with the records. They said they do not provide a completion note of any sort, and that they refer you to the initial, this document here, which shows the dates of everything that are completed. I have completed everything, and I did try to get an additional documentation. They said there is none to have. So I would just be repurchasing this same documents that you have already received.
Okay, so I guess my question for staff then is, did we get this directly from the group, or is it, or are we just relying on what the doctor submitted?
The documents were received from the agency, but there's not from a court. If
we could check the file, but I believe that these were actually submitted by the doctor.
Okay.
I went to the court or the records department, and I ordered to complete everything, and that's what I then scanned and sent to you guys. This is a copy of where the judge signed off on everything. You have it in your records. You're welcome to have it again if you like.
Okay, can I get a motion to go into executive session, please?
I mean, that we're going to do executive session for the purposes of leaving town.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay, ayes have it. We're going to seek legal counsel on this, and we'll be back in just a few minutes. Okay, we're back in regular session. And board members, do you have any questions?
No questions.
No questions? Anybody want to make a motion?
I'll make the motion to terminate this probation early once staff verifies the course release and the completion of the document that we received from our doctor.
Okay, regarding the probation?
Correct.
Okay, is there a second?
Second.
Okay, any further discussion? Okay, hearing none, I'll call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, we've taken action. If you have any further questions, you can talk to staff, but they're just going to go ahead and follow up and just verify that your probation is completed already. Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay, now moving on to tab number 5 under licensure.
Tab 5 is licensure by endorsement with disclosure, Dr. Michael McGurn.
Hi, come on up and please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, hi, Michael McGurn.
Thank you. Okay.
Michael McGurn, D.C., has applied for licensure by endorsement. His application is complete at this time. On the application, Dr. McGurn disclosed that he was arrested for driving under the influence in 1987 and 2002. Dr. McGurn also disclosed that he received a traffic offense around 1984 for refusing a breathalyzer. Board staff has received documentation from the New Jersey Department of Public Safety indicating that there are no records available for the 1985 incident. Board staff received documentation from the Myrtle Beach Police Department and the Municipal Court confirming the arrest and charge of the 1987 DUI. Board staff received documentation from the Tampa Police Department confirming the arrest of the 2002 DUI. Documentation received from the Circuit Court of Hillsborough County indicate that there are no records available.
Okay, so thank you very much for being honest and disclosing.
Oh, absolutely. It
makes it easy on everybody when we can talk openly about these things. Both of your DUIs were a long time ago.
Correct.
And so you can assure us that this isn't going to happen again?
Correct. Yeah, I haven't had a drink since the 2002 Florida incident.
Okay. Board members, do you have any questions for the doctor?
No.
Okay. Somebody want to make a motion?
I'll make a motion to grant licensure upon payment of appropriate fees.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, licensure will be granted upon payment of your fees. Thank you for coming today. Okay.
So does that start today, or is it, am I able to start practicing today or tomorrow?
We will send you notice when the license has been issued.
So don't do anything until I get
not
that.
Not until you've received that notice.
Comes in the mail.
We will email it to you.
Oh, email. Okay, great. Right, thank you so much.
Yeah, that'll be faster for you.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go on to tab number 6.
Tab number 6, Patrick Breda, D.C., has applied for licensure by endorsement and PMPTP. His application is complete at this time.
Hi, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good morning, Patrick D. Rita.
Okay.
Patrick Rita has applied for licensure by endorsement and physical medicine modalities and therapeutic procedures certification. His application is complete at this time. During the application process, board staff became aware that Dr. Rita had been arrested for disorderly conduct on May 18th of 2002 in Sacramento, California. Dr. Rita stated he was not arrested but detained at the Sacramento International Airport. Dr. Rita stated he was released after passing a sobriety test. Board staff has received documentation from the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department and Sacramento County Superior Court. A detention certificate received from the Sacramento County Sheriff's Department indicates that there was no arrest. Documentation received from the Superior Court confirms the arrest and that no charges were filed.
So I'm from the Chicago area, and I get the whole Cubs-White Sox banter back and forth, and it sounds like you got caught up with that with in L.A. So it sounded like you were being either discriminated against because of the jersey you were wearing and not helped in a timely way. And tell us what happened from there. How did you get detained?
Well, it was a long time ago, and I'm actually not even an NBA fan anymore. But I was with friends, and we went to the game. We flew up that same day. They stayed overnight and stuff, but I wanted to get back to work, so I had scheduled a late flight. So I went to the restaurant that they went to after the game, the group, because it was easier to get a taxi to the airport from there. And then I went to the airport, and I wrote a statement of events explaining the whole airport was in memorabilia, and all the employees were wearing the jerseys. So they just basically went and processed my paperwork, and when I complained about it, they called the airport security, you know, because of the airport and all the issues at that time. It was shortly after 9/11. They called the sheriff, and then there was a detention center somewhere in the area right there. I went and told them my story. I thought they were complaining about disorderly conduct, but they did a sobriety test, a number of them. They were all clear. I was released. And I clearly questioned them, you know, because I was from out of town, hey, is this done? Do I have any responsibilities on following up in any manner? And, you know, they just said, you wore the wrong shirt and this is over with, there's nothing. And I, you know, first of all, I'm not familiar with any type of criminal stuff because I've never been involved in anything like that. And I completely forgot about this whole incident. And I've been through a number of background checks over the years. I have a level one security clearance for the state of Arizona. I chaperone children. And, I've been a teacher in the past in the public school system. And when this came up, then, you know, I talked to my lawyer about it, and he said sometimes things just don't fall off of a record. And I would have to, that he would have to go up there. I attempted to have a private investigator handle this for me, and that was just a nightmare because it was unprofessional, a waste of time and money, so I ended up going there. And I received the detention certificate rather quickly at the sheriff's department, and just states all the facts of the date and everything, and said Sacramento County Sheriff's Department that this was a detention only, not an arrest. I submitted that to you folks, thinking that was sufficient, but you wanted a court record. So I did return there, and it said there was an arrest with no charges on file, and referred to the sheriff, who said there was no arrest. I went to the DA just to be sure, and they said they can't do anything because there was no arrest, but they stamped my detention certificate in their little machine, indicating they agree with it. And I submitted all of this to the board, and I'm anxious to contribute positively to the profession here in Arizona. This is, I'm starting my 25th year of private practice with no issues, thank God.
Okay, so we don't want to go through this again. If you are issued a license, you're going to be asked every year, you know, on to disclose any previous arrests and so on. So that's my only concern for staff. You know, I'm not sure how we make note of that, but if you are issued a license, you should probably disclose whatever you have so we don't find it and invite you back again.
When I was in Sacramento, I got two documents. One that would stop this from coming up on any type of background check, and a second to expunge the whole thing. And because of all this and studying for jurisprudence, I have not filed those documents with the court yet, but I plan to do that in the very near future, so hopefully this, I won't have to go through this again.
Okay, and if you do get any additional information, and if you are granted a license today, then make sure we get anything extra that you have.
Yes, sir.
Board members, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Okay. Want to make a motion?
Sure.
I'll make a motion to grant licensure upon payment of appropriate fees.
Okay. Second the motion.
Okay, I'll call for the question. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, you'll be granted a license. Welcome to Arizona.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Okay, tab number 7 regarding Taylor Hoskins.
Taylor Hoskins is applying for licensure by examination and physical medicine modality and therapeutic procedures. Her application is complete at this time. On the application, Dr. Hoskins disclosed that she was arrested for shoplifting in November of 2009 in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and stated that the records were expunged and there are no records available. Court staff has received documentation from the Chattanooga Police and the Hamilton County Criminal Court stating that there are no records available.
Okay. Hi, can you please state your name for the record?
Taylor Hoskins.
Hi, welcome. Board members, do you have any questions?
No questions.
Hearing none, or is there a motion?
I'll make a motion to grant licensure upon payment of appropriate fees.
Second.
Okay, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, you'll be granted a license. Thank you. Okay, on to tab number, under letter H, tab number 8.
Sean Austin has applied for a preceptorship with Matthew Colby, UC. Dr. Colby was issued an advisory letter in February 2009. Regarding advertising, and also issued an advisory letter December 4, 2009 for failing to register a chiropractic assistant within the time required by law.
Okay. Is there a motion?
I'll make a motion to accept the application for this preceptorship.
Second.
Those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the motion carries. Let's go on to tab number 9. For a legislative update.
So this is just to briefly to inform the board of the various legislative actions that have occurred that are going to impact the board in any way. Senate Bill 1086 is about temporary licensure. And so the health professions are main granted authority to the board's executive director to issue and approve licenses, certificates of registration, preceptorships, or reinstatements or waivers. Under this bill, the state may also issue a temporary license to allow an applicant who is not a licensee to practice in this state if the applicant meets all of the following requirements of the state several. And the applicant shall also submit an affidavit of testing that the application meets the requirements of the respective licensing chapter. So basically, the staff will be reviewing perhaps we need to find a way to do temporary licensure and make sure that it meets all of these requirements for the board. So we will be doing this stuff. House Bill 2569, you've heard a lot about. Just bringing that up for disclosure again. And basically, the applicant must hold a license for in another state for at least 1 year. And there was a stipulation about permanent, once an agency decides to factor. The factor or factors that are required to establish the applicant is a resident of the state, the agency should consider adopting and publishing a substantive policy statement on that. And so they've given us a number of things and how we establish residency, and so staff provides a draft memo for the board's consideration on that.
So 2569, is that the governor's push to allow faster track to licensure?
Universal recognition, yes.
Okay.
The House Bill 2118 provides for the health, the regular board, regulatory board to regulate the unauthorized practice of health professions that it also regulates, which basically means that if somebody is accused of practicing without a license, and we get that information. The board verifies that that information is correct. We are mandated to post that person's name on our website for a period of 5 years, so the public knows that that person is not licensed.
So, Mr. Rain, would that mean that we forward it to the Attorney General's office like we normally would if somebody is an unlicensed chiropractor? We have no purview over them, so we forward it to them. But if they're convicted, then we would post it? Or how would that happen?
Briefly, I would just say that I don't understand it to eliminate your injunctive relief powers, that you can still prevent people from a licensed practice. I think it's really in addition to that public notification elements. But, yeah, this shouldn't impact your existing process in terms of stopping the unlicensed practice.
Because we cannot order a cease and desist for somebody who is an unlicensed chiropractor, can we?
I understood that you could.
Okay. I don't mean to ask all the hard questions.
No, that's fine. We haven't had that since I've been working through, but it would be shocking if you didn't have the power to pursue an injunction for unlicensed practice. Most practice without a license is also at least a misdemeanor, and it can be referred for local law enforcement, but you don't get a lot of
Ms. Castro
attention on that.
In the past, maybe 3 years ago, I believe it was the last time we did that, issued a cease and desist, but we would forward that information to the Attorney General's office for them to actually investigate. And this bill is requiring that we post that information on our website.
So just to get the time frame right, so if we issue a cease and desist, would we post it immediately? And then as we're forwarding it to the Attorney General, or do we wait till that's...
With the language of the bill, I would need to review it again, but it does say upon confirmation.
Okay.
So we would need to work that out before we started.
Yeah, I think the language is once the board verifies the accusation. And what that means, we'll probably need the historians to help us with.
So we would have to hire a dog secret agent to go into a veterinary chiropractor's office and then get the dog to report back to us, and then we'd have never mind. Go. I digress. What's the next bill?
Welcome to my new world. In the last instance, House Bill 2463 that simply mandates that we file a new notice on certain places in our website and other documents. And so we will try to find room to do that. Okay. We will find room to do that.
Okay. Do you have a report on applications approved?
I do. And the board has in their possession a list of licensees that I've approved since the last board meeting, and it just suggests that you ratify those for the record.
Okay, is there a motion to ratify?
Yeah, I'll make the motion to ratify this group of doctors for licensure.
I'll second.
Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion carries. Okay. I'm just looking at our current agenda to see that nothing has changed. So in our packet, we have tab numbers 9 and 10. Let's start with number 9 regarding preceptorship training.
Just recently, we received a preceptorship application from a student who is currently enrolled in school and has received her Part 4 scores. She will be enrolled in through December and wants to participate in that preceptorship program that will end before her graduation. And looking at the way we have previously denied applications if their Part 4 scores were available, this seemed to fall out the norm. So I thought I'd bring it to the board for discussion and then perhaps talk about ways to avoid this in the future.
Okay, so for discussion, I don't remember the history of why we would exclude anybody from a preceptorship if they've already taken and passed or failed their national boards.
And the only answer I have is that previously the policy has been if the Part 4 board score is already available upon application of the preceptorship, it's been denied.
Does that mean they're so smart that they don't have to take a preceptorship?
Well, I mean, the rule that you have to terminate it does seem to indicate that if you are out of that, you know, you've passed that exam, or you're not in school, right, in addition to that.
Yeah, I think what the
statute doesn't provide that limitation, so it's a rule-based.
Yeah, it's an interpretation. Okay.
So,
it's not, I mean, I think the rule's pretty explicit.
That, right.
You can't do it. But the rule is not mandated by statute. I think that it would require a rule change to allow preceptorships that violate that part of the rule.
So for discussion, board members, do you see any reason why that rule makes any sense at all? Or is it something that we should change and make a political run at and maybe involve the state association to rally behind?
I have a perception of why that rule is stated the way it is for people who have not yet taken Part 4 and passed it is because they may not pass it in the future. And so that rule is written, I think, to prevent somebody from staying in a preceptorship longer than 6 months, longer than past the next Part 4. It wasn't, I don't think, intended to mean that if you pass Part 4, it's not a problem. It's if
okay.
You didn't pass it, you can't go more than another 6 months on preceptorship.
That makes sense.
But I mean, it kind of in the same line, this Senate bill 1086 for temporary licensure, does that start to have any effect on this? Because now we're I'm just trying to think about how that plays into preceptorship as well, because we can grant temporary licensure for students.
No.
Or they have to have been graduated, but they're still not able.
I think temporary licensure still requires some portion having already had a health license.
Yeah, I think a temporary license would be for a traveling teaching professional, or maybe somebody goes somewhere for a rodeo and they're there for the weekend, and so now they're under the whatever state they travel to, they're now legitimately temporarily licensed, so their malpractice insurance will cover them. And then also now they're subject to whatever laws that they're involved in, whatever state that they're in. But the preceptorship, I don't see why that would be excluded with the Part 4.
The interpretation was that they don't want people to be in a preceptorship and keep failing Part 4.
Okay.
Right.
Like indefinitely. And that's happened before.
So there could be a little wordsmithing on that then to clarify it, but it would take a legislative effort.
Well, it would be a rulemaking, that sort of rulemaking, I think, is welcome. You know, rulemaking that isn't more restrictive but less restrictive. You could just tell a moratorium on rulemaking, but this would sound like one that could get an exemption.
So is there a, when is there a sunset?
It's coming up. 2 years?
I believe it is next summer.
Next year.
Yeah. Okay, so that's when everything is kind of open and under review, and we can consider it for then, but we should go into that ready.
Yeah, or you could, I mean, rulemaking can happen anytime, but it is a bit of a process, so typically I think most boards try and clean up a variety of things when they're going into rulemaking, so that might be the best time to do it, but just to be clear, you could, this was an emergency type rule change. It started right away.
It may not be an emergency, but I did the same day that I reviewed that file, I received a call from Western States, and their manager of the preceptorship program thought that three people may fall into that. And so I don't know if it's a calendar issue with Western States this particular time.
You know, one thing that I propose is that I didn't get the material for this to prepare before the meeting. But if you could, I could consult with colleagues and see if perhaps with a substantive policy statement interpreting this rule, that perhaps you could exclude people who have passed the exam, because then the release of the score, I mean, would be kind of irrelevant. But I mean, as it reads, it doesn't provide for that. But if I can get a consensus in my office, that wouldn't be a direct contradiction to the rule. Even if everyone disagrees with the rule, we can't just ignore it. But if there is some room there on further examination, then perhaps a substantive policy statement interpreting it for a unique circumstance where someone's actually passed the exam could pass muster and give the authority for staff to proceed on those unique circumstances. But just at first blush, it just says what it says, and it might be illogical, but that happens sometimes. There is some law just generally in statutory interpretation, which rules are just interpreted by statutes, that if there's an absurd result, even though the plain language of a rule or a statute says this, you know, you must do X, but if that just is absurd and everyone would agree on that, there is some ability to disregard the plain language of a rule. So I can look into that a little further and with staff bring it back to subsequent meeting to see if there's a solution proposed.
Okay.
And if I could just clarify for the record that our sunset review is summer of 2021.
Thank you. Okay, any further discussion on this tab? Hearing none, let's go to tab number 10 regarding continuing education requirements.
This may also be something that the board wants to push up to the sunset review. But I would just bring it to your attention, because if I were a CE course applicant, I would have questions, and as a new staff member, I had questions. And so if you've had a chance to read my memo, that's it in a nutshell. But I wanted to open the conversation, because I think it needs to be addressed. The language is just a little loose.
Okay, so one of the things that stands out is the, can you clarify how we charge for, let's say that somebody wants to offer a course and they're calling their course a 12-hour course versus a 60-hour course. My understanding is right now it's the same fee. It's not based on the number of hours of continuing education that are offered.
That's the way it's been interpreted. If it comes in, the application comes in, and they call the content a course, it's simply a $50 fee.
Which really is not fair to somebody who, you know, if you're offering a four-hour course, you're going to make a certain amount of money as you fill up a classroom for that four-hour course versus somebody who offers a 60-hour course, but they're paying the same fee, and then staff has a lot more work to try to review it and decide if it's legitimate or not.
And for a 60-hour course, perhaps there will be, you know, a dozen instructors, and all of those instructors have to be reviewed by staff, and so each one of those has a time element involved. Each one of those instructors has sent us a syllabus, and so it gives essentially five times the work to staff as that 12-hour course.
Never thought of that before. Very good. So each subject, like what an attorney may do at a seminar for the doctors, and it's 8 hours, but it's broken down into two by one instructor on a subject, two on another subject by another instructor. Those you're suggesting should be paid for separately, right?
No, a course of study over a weekend like that, I think all goes toward a similar outcome, or a course outcome, an educational outcome, and I think that could be what would be considered a course. But something that is, you know, 60 hours long and might touch on a variety of subjects,
okay,
might be something that the board would consider not a course.
So what would be the deciding factor, the number of hours or the number of instructors or the number of classes, subject
matter? That's exactly why I've tied it up for discussion.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, in educational terms, you know, a course of study can be, you know, a very lengthy kind of thing. But I'm looking at it from the management side and the business side. And
even though a course of study might be very long, the college is going to charge you by the semester hour.
Right.
And so a model like that might be something that the board would consider.
So hours would be your recommendation?
That's one of the ones to consider. I'd like to look into all the ramifications of whatever decision is made or options the board may want to suggest.
And if I may, I would just say that this is the place usually where I would say there's not a lot of risk involved in making a discretionary decision for board staff to evaluate each course on its merits and just make a determination in case the rule doesn't get clarified either better. I wouldn't expect people to go to the expense and time to litigate over the fee that they get charged. So my recommendation, at least out here in the public session, is to say that staff has apparently been, you know, applying their discretion and evaluating them on a course-by-course basis, but maybe get some guidance from the board on how they'd like you to do that. Marching orders would probably solve the problem without getting a rule change, because no one's going to spend $10,000 on an attorney to fight about a course fee, which isn't that large compared to the expensive fighting over it. So I would recommend that staff could continue to apply their discretion, but maybe it sounds like you also want some, you know, well, board preferences or something.
One of my concerns about changing it just by strictly a directive from the board is that some of these courses may have already been approved and there's some precedent for them, and without a substantive change in the rulemaking, that someone might sort of object.
They may object, but I think that's about as far as it would like to go.
So I guess I would suggest, well, first I have a question. So what if somebody has a 1 hour course, what if we charge
$50?
And what if somebody had a 20 hour course, it would be 50 as well right now? Okay.
It's $50 per application. So they're telling us how long that course is.
Okay, so what about maybe a sliding scale, like $50 will cover 1 through 5 hours and $100 would be 6 through 10, or would that seem fair or not so much? Or $50 for 3 hours, and you know, is it more work to review a 3 hour course versus a 1 hour course? Probably not much. Unless you have three different instructors.
It's really going to depend on the provider. Some providers are really skilled in how they apply and they put it all together in a nice, neat package for us. They know. But to make a change like that, you need to do, you know, a rule change in order to change that fee, because it just says course application fee is $50. So we have always operated with the idea that when a course is approved, then everyone who's taking that course is getting the same educational experience. Mm-hmm. So if they're saying that it's 16 hours, then it's a 16-hour course, and that's fine. But when you get up into 60 hours and 70 hours, then we start to say, oh, that's obviously not how it's being presented to the doctors attending. And so that's where we started to push back a little bit. But in digging, we found that in the past it had been approved that way.
Have we, through our meetings nationally, have we talked to other states about how they do things? Because we don't want to drive people out of town to do their continuing education at the same point, and we don't want to discourage people from wanting to provide CE here. Do we know?
From what I have heard, Arizona seems, we are told that we are one of the harder to work with for CE because of the way that the CE rule is written.
Not because of the fee?
Right.
Okay.
It's because of how it's written and the requirements of applying. So that kind of turns some people away in itself.
And so another option is to go the pre-approved continuing education route through FCLB?
Through the PACE, mm-hmm. Right, which is why we started to move that way to make it a little easier for those providers.
Isn't it automatic if it's approved through the PACE?
It would be automatic, but I don't know if we can actually discuss the application, but we did receive a PACE application, and it was for something like 70 hours, and that's why we kind of pushed back a little bit, because the content there's no concern about, but it's that same educational experience and approving a course that you don't really know what they're going to be learning because they're, you know,
a lot of hours.
They don't have to.
They don't have to take all of that.
Oh, really?
Well, you know, and then you know, it's just like not showing up for class.
Okay.
You know,
they could take 3 hours only if they wanted to. That wasn't the intention of us pre-approving a course and issuing the approval code.
Isn't that also going to be the case with national conferences where they offer up to 26 credits over a couple of days, and then attendees might not go to all of them?
Right.
So is there a difference between how that is regulated or constructed versus this kind
of situation? So what we have done in the past is worked with them to kind of have them submit like a track, like maybe break that up into 3 or 4 different tracks, like so that we can approve it that way in a more reasonable way, and not just one blanket course for the entire, you know, seminar.
So that's why we see when we go to seminars, we always get to see like a special Arizona designation where it's approved with California typically.
Yes.
All right.
I would expect that when you get the materials, you're going to have lots of indicators of when each course concludes and the next course starts. Even if it's presented as one course, there may be a break with a new instructor coming in. There may be subject matter headings, you know, that are clearly distinguishable from the prior, you know, chapter in the courses that they may try and fit it into one course. But if one is on billing and then the next segment of the course is another instructor teaching record keeping, then I think staff has a lot of discretion, in my impression, to just say we're calling that a separate course and that's a separate fee and to approve it, but to use their discretion and to ask for further information to get the information you need to make that decision. And I honestly just don't think there's a lot of room or desire probably out there to challenge staff's decisions on what fee to charge, determining on when they determined that one course ended and the other one started. And I just find it hard to believe that there'd be a 60-hour course on any subject.
Do we take that track approach too with online courses like ChiroCredit, right? Sometimes they'll match them up into one 12-hour program to meet all of Arizona's. Are we saying, well, you gotta register record keeping for every even number of year, and those are the 2 hours that get mashed in with orthopedic and evaluation. Do we keep that same kind of track consistency even with online programs?
For the online, we should be keeping that consistency, but if it's a 12-hour course, a 12-hour online course, we're assuming that they're taking a 12-hour course. But if we actually digged into it, we're seeing that they're splitting it up into 1 hour or 2 hour or 3 hour segments. And I think that's where the issue arose from an online course like that.
Or maybe from the fee, you know, just a rule change that makes it by hour, something quite objective.
I like that fee by the hour.
You might still have to approve the course on its merits and do all that still, but in terms of what fee you charge is per hour. And that's a lot of times how they bill it to the, at least a lot of fees charged by the hour.
So the two-hour course would be like $30, $60 for that record-keeping class, right?
Yeah,
and then 4 more hours in any clinical would be $120. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, well, Ms. Castro's right. I think that to the extent you had something like that where you're changing the way you charge the fee to approve the course, you have to have a rule change because it's about course now. Mm-hmm. But if you can have a rule change.
Can we have a rule change that it's by hour and not say what the fee is? And reserve the right to change it whenever that's appropriate.
Well, you can
put a cap on the fee.
Yeah.
Like you did with licensure.
Well, I think we want to put a minimum on it, not a cap.
Oh, well,
I mean, because someone could have a $500 course, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is it true, though, that it's not just what fee you charge, but also whether you have to get independent evaluation for the approval of the subject matter.
It's staff work, yeah. So each instructor has to, you know, provide independent licensure about verification and their CV and their letter of reference, and all of those things have to be logged and put into the file. And so it just takes, you know, a longer time to do a bigger course with more instructors than it does with a single person doing a four-hour record keeping course.
How many of these big courses do we get applying? Or is it these one-off, trying to fulfill the 12 hours for Arizona, single instructor?
What, or what if we said per course and or every 5 hours? You know, so if somebody has a 20-hour module course, they're paying four fees, even if they call it one course.
I think whatever the board decides is fine.
But we're looking at you.
I will read what the actual rule about the fee is in 1301. It says that continuing education course review for approval, $50. So that's what would need to be changed in order to change how you're billing it or how much you're billing,
okay,
charging for it.
So we would have to define what a course is or how many hours that's limited to.
Or the idea of per hour, that's a very simple management task. Mm-hmm. You know, you just, whatever they're applying for, and you apply, you know, 10, 15, 25, whatever the board thinks is reasonable, and is not burdensome to the people wanting to provide courses here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can I direct staff to maybe reach out to some of our neighboring friendly states and see what the pulse is and what they're charging and where we fit in on that?
Absolutely.
and then bring it back on a separate agenda on another day?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we're to the good of the order. Or the call to the public. So this is our chance to reach out to our audience here. You can come up to the microphone or not. You can say whatever you want to say. We are not able to respond to you. You can't ask us questions, or you can, but we just can't answer. So I'd like to start over on this side. You know, what were your impressions of our meeting today? If you have any comments.
I'm here just because you have a requirement, of course, to attend the board meeting. And, I've probably been licensed in about 10 different states. This is the first state that ever had that requirement, so it's a new experience for me. But it made me understand kind of what you go through when you make all the rules and regulations. I guess I can say I enjoyed it.
Anybody else? No comments? Nothing? Okay. I'll take a final motion.
I'll make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Okay. Those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Okay. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.